New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Season 3, Episode 2 of Dealing Justice. I'm Jennifer Dubasek.
And I'm Lori Jennings. In today's episode, we delve into the horrific murder of Brittany Phillips, a vibrant 18-year-old college student living in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Brittany was last seen alive entering her apartment complex on the night of September 27, 2004. 3 days later, a shocking twist emerges when her lifeless body was discovered.
We would love to see the day when there are no faces to put on the cold case playing cards, but until that day comes, we will continue telling these stories in pursuit of dealing justice.
It's time for us to solve these cases one card at a time.
Help us deal justice for Brittany Phillips.
This is episode 4, the Brittany Phillips case, Two of Diamonds, Oklahoma Deck. This episode of Dealing Justice brings us to Tulsa, Oklahoma, where the heart of the Sooner State becomes the stage for a gruesome murder that launches a mother on a caravan to catch a killer for almost two decades. Brittany Yvonne Sarah Phillips was born on October 4, 1985 in St. Petersburg, Florida, to Maggie Zingman and John Phillips. She completed the family and joined her big brother Joshua, who was only 15 months old at the time. Her mother, Maggie, tells us more about her fearless trailblazer who wasn't afraid to shine.
At year two, she started growing these curls, and she would just stop traffic. By the time she was three or four, she had these long blonde curls that would cascade down her back, and she was only, you know, maybe 2 feet, and her hair was probably, you know, half of her length. From the minute she came out running, I think, you know. She was very outgoing. She was she didn't have one fearful bone in her body. So even by the age of six, she had already had stitches in her forehead, in her chin, because she was jumping in pools backwards. You know, she was just, she just didn't have any fear of the world back then and stuff. And she would always dress herself like many young kids do in quirky little clothes. And she loved hats. And so she was just, I'm prejudiced, but she was beautiful. And she was intelligent, too. I mean, they gave us a grant for her to start kindergarten a whole year early, because she was just, even then, she was showing, you know, just this ability to learn. So her whole school life, she was always a year younger than everybody.
Maggie also tells us how Brittany was your typical 80s kid. She had a passion for fashion and loved living close to the happiest place on earth.
Growing up in Florida, you know, Disney, everything. I still, when I travel, I have a Mickey, or hers is a Minnie Mouse backpack that she had that she used in grade school and kindergarten that she had gotten down there. And so she always would have little Mickey things, because, I mean, they were going to Disney World and Epcot since they were babies. And she would always love that she had pictures of her with the band leader at Disney World or something, because of these beautiful brown curls and these hats she would wear and these impish grins. I have some pictures of her sitting on the curb in Disney. She would always get picked for those things. So, and part of it was just these quirky costumes that she loved creating, you know.
Maggie and John divorced when Brittany and Joshua were in elementary school. Maggie and the kids first moved to Kentucky and eventually found their way to Oklahoma in 1991. Maggie worked as a trauma psychologist in 1995 when tragedy struck Oklahoma City.
A massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City.
The bomb went off just after 9 in the morning when most people were in their offices.
It was an attack on innocent children and defenseless citizens.
Maggie tells us that even at a young age, Brittany was an empath who deeply felt the emotions of others.
She went up with me to Oklahoma City, and I worked at the Oklahoma City bombing, and there's a big fence. And then she just, when we went up to the fence, she just, you know, started crying, and she was leaving notes on it. So she's always had a passionate feeling and empathy towards others. Her heart hurt for so many people.
Not only was Brittany kind and compassionate, but she also worked incredibly hard in school. She went to Union High School in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where she had the ability to connect with everyone.
If I ran into somebody who knew her, you know, that, well, I wasn't part of this group, I wasn't part of that group, and Brittany would sit with me or study with me or help tutor me or whatever. I mean, she really wasn't part of any group, but, you know, she was very beautiful, so she at least looked like she was part of the popular group, but she really didn't hang that much with them. But so she really had this ability, which maybe ends up being, you know, part of the issue, to just befriend people. You know, she'd give them the benefit of the doubt.
In 2003, after graduating high school at 17, Brittany received a full chemistry scholarship to Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida. Maggie was extremely proud, since this was her alma mater.
When I can remember dropping her off at Eckerd and go and just seeing her in the rearview mirror and, you know, thinking, this is where, oh God, what if I never see her again? You know, leaving her 2,000 miles away was what I feared.
As it turns out, Maggie had no reason to worry. Brittany did great her first year at school, and it was smooth sailing, with the exception of Brittany being homesick. So much so that she made the decision to move back to Tulsa and close to the people she loved. Making her way back to Tulsa did seem to make Brittany happy. She was planning to attend Tulsa Community College and then applied to Oklahoma University. And as Brittany was craving familiarity, Maggie was embracing change. She had gotten a job an hour away in Chandler, Oklahoma, where she was in the process of moving.
I was finally got this job at the prison, the female prison that I worked at, and my salary went up threefold. You know, it still wasn't great, but I was, you know, just at the cusp of being able to do stuff for her. And of course, you know, I was helping her financially because she was going to the junior college to make up some classes so she could transfer to the state school.
In August of 2004, Brittany moved into her own one-bedroom apartment at the Glen Eagles complex, right across the street from her old high school.
When she first moved in, we thought, we've never heard anything bad about this. You know, she was at Union, that campus of Union High School, for 4 years. We never heard anything bad. We knew people moved there. We did a search on the police. I mean, they weren't as good as they are now, but, you know, we didn't find anything. We went and talked to the people, and of course they did a background check on her, which of course she totally cleared, you know. And so I thought, well, this is good. And her brother had been out, you know, and of course she used that, you know, well, you've let Josh live on his own. You know, she always knew how to argue. She, at one point, she said she was going to become a lawyer, but instead of a chemist. But, you know, so she was excited about it.
Although Maggie was an hour away, Brittany's brother Joshua lived nearby, and Brittany would visit her mom on the weekends.
You know, for the first while, I was down there on the weekends. And then once I got my home, she would come up over the weekend. So she always had me near.
Brittany loved living on her own and felt safe until she met a security guard that made her a little uncomfortable.
This was a security guard at Woodland Hills Mall. It's around the corner from her apartment. It's around the corner from her high school where she went for 4 years. You know, it's all in that local vicinity. And so, you know, she was my daughter, so she was a shopper. She had met him at the mall. And I guess, you know, initially she seemed to like him. I don't think they ever went out. She ended up blocking his number.
Regardless of the situation, Brittany felt she handled it well and was settling into her independence and a bright future in Tulsa. But just a month later, everything would change.
Monday, September 27th, 2004. That morning, Brittany wasn't feeling well. She struggled with sinus issues her whole life, so this was nothing new. In spite of that, she went to her class where she saw her brother Joshua on campus, and they exchanged a brief hello. Later that evening, around 6 o'clock, Brittany went to urgent care, where she waited for more than 2 hours, a Upset about the wait, she called Maggie to vent her frustrations.
She called me at the urgent care, which was about 6:30 or something, because I think that's right after she saw her brother. She had been there for 2 hours, so she probably called me around 8:30, and that's when I told her, I will try to find you a doctor. I will try to find something out for you, and when you come up this weekend, we'll work it out. Then she went and dropped off her friend. We think then, because Jeff, the first great detective, found a receipt from Bank of America near her apartment. Then she probably went home, and I think I talked to her when she got home just briefly, just to say, you know, let's come up this weekend and we'll, you know, work this out.
Maggie had no idea that phone call would be the last time she would ever hear her daughter's voice. Tuesday, September 28th. Maggie called Brittany, but was unable to reach her. She assumed that Brittany was just busy with school, and she continued to believe that when she also didn't hear back from her on Wednesday, September 29th. Thursday, September 30th, 2004. Maggie calls Brittany, and once again, it went to voicemail.
At the tone, please record your message.
And now Maggie begins to feel uneasy. Sure, kids get busy and calling mom back isn't a priority, but Maggie felt it was time to amp up the urgency. She left Brittany a message conveying that sentiment.
But I left that mom message of, Brittany, I know you're okay, but you know I get worried when you don't call me all night. Please, please give me a call back.
In the meantime, Brittany's friends were also getting concerned. It was unlike Brittany to miss classes 2 days in a row, and no one had heard from her. One of her friends went to her apartment to check on her. She called the Tulsa Police Department to do a welfare check. Police arrive at roughly 10 p.m. in response to the welfare check call for 18-year-old Brittany Phillips. After no response to their knocking, they gain entrance and discovered a horrific scene. They discovered Brittany's body. On September 30th at 10:09 p.m., Brittany Phillips was pronounced dead on the scene. Friday, October 1st, 2004. It's storming outside after midnight in Chandler, Oklahoma, where Maggie was home sleeping when she is awakened by a knock at the door.
That's when I got the knock on the door. And this very scared young Chandler sheriff sticks his hand in my face and says, are you Maggie Singh? When I said yes, he goes, you need to call Tulsa police. Your daughter's been murdered. And then he left. And it was like out of a movie because there's this big storm, you know, and stuff. But I mean, here I'm just going, he must have something. He must be mixed up, you know, which you do anyways, you know. But when somebody does it that way, you're going, wait. And he's not even standing there anymore. So I can't ask questions. And I'm just sort of falling back on my stairs that went upstairs and just not knowing what to do for a while. First thing I had to finally get myself to do is call this number because I was sure that they were wrong, you know, and that's when I first talked to Felton. He said, yes, you know, I can't tell you anything. We don't know anything, but she was found dead. And he said she probably was dead for 3 days, but I need you to come down to Tulsa and I'll get there as soon as I can. And so that was then that I got into this, which we all do, you know, this crazy thinking, who do I call? I don't want to wake up anybody because it was now 2 a.m., you know. Do I call my parents in New York? I don't want to wake them up, but of course I'm going to call my parents. You know, I called my best friend who, you know, I knew it was going to devastate her. And so she and her husband drove up to come up to help me drive down.
Maggie arrived at her daughter's apartment to find that Brittany's body had already been taken away by the medical examiner.
When I got there, the police officer that came out said, who are you? You know, and he said she was already identified by her license. You know, and here again, no rule book. I didn't know about having a voice. So I'm told by a sheriff with a little piece of paper who runs away. And then I get down expecting, fearing of seeing my daughter, but expecting to see my daughter and didn't know I had a right to ask to see the body and was told nothing, you know, at that point.
Maggie was desperate to see her daughter and say goodbye to the child she brought into this world.
funeral director would not let me see her. My sister and I went in there to say goodbye to her. And he said, I can't let you see her. Like, what, you can't let me see my daughter? He said, well, you can see, you can say goodbye to her with this green cover over her face. That's actually, as you can hear my voice, that's how I said goodbye to her, with a blanket over her head, where I took my hand down her nose and just put my head on her chest and just said, I'm sorry.
Meanwhile, the Tulsa police were starting their investigation. Investigators stated there did not appear to be any signs of forced entry. They've also said it is not known if her attacker was inside her apartment waiting for her or if she was attacked while she was sleeping, but her home had signs of an altercation. According to the medical examiner's office, Brittany was lying on the floor right next to her bed with her head turned to the right. There were numerous towels thrown on Brittany and items of clothes next to her. She was only wearing a shirt. She had been raped and suffocated. No evidence of ligature use, meaning someone used their bare hands or a pillow or an obstruction of some sort to murder her. While police were still searching for her killer, Brittany was laid to rest on October 4th, 2004, which would have been her 19th birthday.
Days after the murder, while Maggie was cleaning out her daughter's apartment, she noticed the trellis on Brittany's balcony was damaged. According to reports, the balcony doors were open when Brittany was found. Maggie recalled that Brittany mentioned she had previously locked herself out of her apartment and a neighbor had boosted her up to her balcony on the second floor, where the doors were unlocked and she was able to gain access. This means it would have been easy for someone else to do the same. How the killer gained access has not been determined. So one big question remains, how did the killer get in? Perhaps another terrifying option is the possibility that Brittany's killer accessed her apartment through the attic, which she shared with seven other apartments. All eight apartments had access points in each closet. Feasibly, this meant that anybody from these apartments had access to the neighboring units through this shared attic space. The original detective on Brittany's case, Detective Jeff Felton, even tested out this theory.
You know, Jeff, the first day he was there, said, did you know about this? And Jeff was 6'2", and he went into the closet and he pushed the little square round thing. I mean, I have one in my house that goes up into my attic. You know, it's just like a three by three square. And he pushed it over and he pulled himself up in it. And so somebody could have done that. That's where people would lay wires, you know.
Over the years, police have speculated that Brittany's killer somehow gained entry to her apartment before she got home on the evening of Monday, September 27th, 2004. It's possible that after speaking with her mom and dropping off her friend, she returned to her apartment where the killer was waiting and immediately attacked her. A second theory is the killer simply followed her in or was invited. If that's the case, then Brittany would have known her killer. Detectives followed all leads and thoroughly investigated Brittany's ex-boyfriends, friends, classmates, and any male she had contact with, including neighbors, employees, and public service workers who may have had access to her apartment. They also checked for surveillance cameras in the area.
They had a camera at the storage place that was right outside the fence that was outside her apartment. And by the time I got there and by the time the detective got there, it was on a 24-hour loop. You know, back in those days, it didn't, you know. That's a hard thing, I think, for some people sometimes now, is to understand how far back the technology was then, you know.
Right, yeah, that we didn't have that. People didn't have Ring doorbells or anything like that to know or have answers. Yeah.
DNA evidence at the time was compared to more than 3,000 possible suspects, and no matches were ever found. Brittany's case went cold. Maggie refused to give up, and in 2007, she put her passion into creating the Caravan to Catch a Killer concept. Consumed by grief and driven by determination, Maggie set out for a relentless pursuit to catch the killer of her child. This is a journey for justice and a testament to the love of a mother.
Only onto a mother's scorn is possibly the strongest force there is out there.
And it's what's driving a cold case we've followed since 2004.
You have a choice. You either go crazy or you end up doing something in honor of them.
But it's about me trying to find my daughter's killer.
Her car tells the story. Zingman left her home in Oklahoma and hit the road with Brittany's image by her side. In each city, she hands out flyers telling Brittany's story.
We're, you know, trying to find tips, but we're also trying to change some laws.
She's also fighting for more DNA testing and tougher punishment for rapists.
The idea of this man still being out there, I just cannot sit with, and I'll keep doing this, you know, in whatever way I can until we find him.
At first, I just put some flyers on my car, and it brought some people up to ask questions. And then I started thinking, you know, there's got to be a way to do this. And maybe if I just start taking it across the U.S., then maybe that's the way to get national news. And even to admitting that back then I knew I had to have a hook. And so together, you know, I don't know how. I wanted something that people could remember, and I wanted something, maybe the poet in me. I came up with a caravan to catch a killer. I never knew where I was going to go. I just started doing it, and I would write emails before I got to a city. I would look up reporters, try to find some focus that they did, email them. When I got to the city, I would re-follow up and hopefully do a story and then stay there a day later while I was writing emails to the next city for him. So I went places where I know, you know, people might be hiding out, big cities, all that. And it was just something that initially evolved because I wanted to get her story out there.
Maggie's vehicle is bright pink and purple. It's wrapped with photos of Brittany, and it lists contact information for anyone who may have information on Brittany's murder. Maggie travels the country hoping someone will see Brittany's face and come forward with information.
I've traveled 300 plus thousand miles through 48 states on 23 tours.
Maggie's caravan across the nation kept her busy, but there was still not justice for Brittany, and her killer was still out there somewhere. Detectives believe they had the DNA of the killer and tested it against nearly 3,000 men, but there was never a match. In May of 2018, officials created a forensic composite drawing of what the suspect would have looked like based off that DNA. It showed a white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed male at around the age of 25 years old.
There were a lot of good tips. It really generated stuff. And then I get a call, and the detective calls, and he said, well, as we expected, it was a direct match.
You would think this would mean the case is solved. However, this is where things take a twist.
According to the Tulsa Police Department, that person was ruled out due to an alibi, and he also had a plausible reason for his DNA to be at the scene. He was the boyfriend of one of Brittany's friends and had actually stayed the night in Brittany's apartment with his girlfriend shortly before the murder. So the bottom line now, the police no longer believe the DNA collected at the scene from the sheets and the wall are connected to the murderer. That leaves a huge question. If the DNA is not from the killer and suspects were ruled out based on that DNA profile, they would need to go back to square one. There was also DNA collected from under Brittany's fingernails and the rape kit. We requested an interview with the Tulsa Police Department and have yet to get a response.
It's a waiting game at this time to see if additional DNA will be tested in Brittany's case, and the police are not sharing any information on any new DNA testing. Then, in February of 2023, some new information has come forward that may or may not hold answers.
New tonight, a grieving mother is hoping that new evidence could possibly shed some light on her daughter's unsolved murder. Tonight, 2 News anchor Sharon Phillips speaks with her mother about this evidence discovered by the family and what she's asking from the community.
Her mother, Maggie Zingman, says she got a call from Brittany's father recently that left her stunned.
All of a sudden, about a month ago, I got this call from him, and he said, I need to show you something, but don't be upset with me.
Brittany's father told Maggie that he had recently discovered a birthday card Brittany had sent to him in 2004 to mail to her grandfather.
It had a mechanized white post office stamp, meaning it came out of a machine that somebody either bought at a kiosk or a post office desk.
The date on the card is September 29th. Which is postmarked after her death.
Could be that Brittany sent it, meaning her timeline is wrong on her death, because the police have said consistently for 18 years that she died sometime between September 27th, that Monday night, and I had talked to her about 9, so they assume it's after 9 and 8 a.m. the next morning, the 28th.
Maggie is asking anyone who may have mailed the card to come forward, because that could possibly change the timeline of her death.
This was mailed. It came out of a machine on the 29th. Somebody had to mail it.
Maggie says she hopes this new piece of evidence will trigger someone's memory and help her solve her daughter's murder.
If Brittany was the one who mailed the card, this could change a lot about the case, specifically her time of death.
In addition to her caravan to catch a killer work, Maggie runs a website dedicated to Brittany's case. It's BrittanyPhillipsMurder.net. Maggie continues to bring attention to her daughter's case, but admits lack of communication with the Tulsa Police Department and lack of national attention to her daughter's story is beginning to wear on her.
I know now Tulsa Police they're understaffed. They're extremely busy. I know many are dedicated to this case, but a shutdown on communication, behaviors that feel like they're retaliatory, meaning like they're getting back at me. It almost feels like whistleblower retaliation. And I can not feel any different if they don't communicate with me. It's the lack of communication that allows the mind to go in all these different directions. And I'm not speaking for just me. I'm speaking because I am always, always going to be the advocate for homicide families and for survivors. But without the communication, it feels like we're alone in this. And I respect that everybody, you know, is busy. I respect that they're dedicated to the case. But think about how, for the police, think about how you would feel if this was your child. Not that I'm being unrealistic, but I can't change what's happened in our case, but I am, before I die, because I'm turning 70 in February, I will make a difference where this doesn't keep happening.
In Maggie's grief, she wrote a poem to express her love for her daughter, and it seemed fitting to add here. A gift has been taken back. On October 4th, 1985, your bright eyes opened to the world, and on this day, 19 years later, your eyes closed for the last time. My little girl with long blonde curls, you were taken too soon. Your youth and aged wisdom are now locked inside. You were the smiling, spinning, dancing pony princess. You were the young woman who wanted to research ways to heal. You loved deeper than many and hurt twice as hard. You touched all that you ever met, but my hands, which once held the warmth of your face, that gently touched your forehead and caressed down across your face when you were scared, these hands are aching with loss. We all ache with loss, for there was so much you had to give. My little pretty Brittany, one last time I say, remember my smile and kisses, my arms wrapped tightly around you, keeping you safe inside. In this way, I hold you forever. If you have any information about Brittany's case, you can call the Tulsa Police Department at 918-596-9222 or Crime Stoppers at 918-596-COPS, which is 918-567-2677. Or call Crime Stoppers at 918-596-2677. And remember, through Crime Stoppers, you can be anonymous.
Thank you for joining us on the Brittany Phillips case. This one, you know, we say this all the time. They're all so sad. I think, you know, I have a daughter that is 18 and first year in college. And so this hits home once again, because you're trusting that you have to let go and you have to let them go out there and dive into the world and be independent. And this is just every parent's worst nightmare that something like this would happen.
And especially so relatable, as you said, like your daughter's first year, like when they don't text us back and they don't call us back, like you can really relate to that. Oh, they're just busy. They're just being, you know, it's just the reality of, wait, something tragic could be happening. I don't know. That just, I feel like every mother has that time sometimes when they don't get back to us and our mind starts to wander.
Right. But I also think that, you know, when you put them out there, there comes a time where they go from 0 to 60. They go from the safety of your home where you're locking the doors, where you're able to keep them safe, and then to transitioning them, you know, almost overnight to living on their own and to keeping themselves safe. And so I think that's really what just makes this so tragic, is that Maggie did such a good job, and you know, Brittany as well, and yet something bad was still able to happen to her. So, you know, let's talk about the suspects. What are your thoughts?
There's so many. You know, it can go from anything of somebody she knew, somebody she didn't know, the kid who, you know, and I don't mean to put names, I don't even know the guy's name, but the neighbor who boosted her up, did that give an idea? Did somebody watch him boost her up on that balcony and think, huh, I can get in there, which would be a random assailant? The security guard that he was kind of stalking her, she had to block his number, you know.
Well, and we know now that that's happened a lot, obviously, right here in Orlando. We've had, you know, a very high profile case where someone that worked with the apartment complex had keys and was able to enter the home and kill the young lady inside. Same thing. She was going to school. And so that is now, that case has really changed things and made people aware of who has keys that can get into these apartments. But I also think, you know, obviously, I don't know how I feel about the boyfriend's DNA.
I know. I keep going back to that too. And I get it. DNA does not lie. And I get it. Like, okay, there's a plausible reason why his DNA would be there. But let's face it. That matched. But I guess, you know, you only get one shot to convict someone if he is innocent, you know, and he didn't do it, that they have to make sure that everything is crossed. And the fact that he had a plausible reason and an alibi for that night.
Well, let's remind them what's the plausible reason?
That he had slept with his girlfriend, and obviously they slept in that bed, and they had...
Why would they sleep in Brittany's bed?
He said that, you know, they had sex and they were there, and that's why his DNA was there. And she confirmed it, and that's what they have. But again, we don't know about the rape kit, and we don't know about the DNA under the fingernails. The police did confirm that the DNA that they tested was the one that was on the wall and on the sheets. And so that gave them plausible reason for the man who matched the DNA, but also matched the description. So they got they put the picture up. The reason why there was never a DNA match before all this is because he, you know, if you think about it, when they interviewed everybody, they obviously didn't get him, or they didn't get a match, because they said they tested more than 3,000 people, but yet his DNA would have matched that right on. It waited until they had a profile of what the killer would have looked like based on that DNA. Then they got tips of that name, which came back to a connection of somebody that actually was a boyfriend of Brittany's friend who was closely within her circle. But basically, his name did not come up, and there wasn't that DNA match until they had the profile of what the killer would look like. That's when they were given the name. That's when they tested his DNA. And that's when there was that match. But then he had the plausible reason and the alibi of why his DNA would be there. So then they couldn't move any further.
So, but I still find that one, I feel like really we should dig into more. Or to me, that's the one that's really hard to get past. I mean, yes, it could have been a total stranger, could have been somebody walking by, but it just seems that, I mean, you know, things happen. But I still find that I'd be very interested to know where the DNA leads them underneath her fingernails and in the rape kit.
Exactly. And we hope that that's just it. The police just, it's an open investigation. They haven't gotten back to us. They're not really talking and communicating with Maggie. And you and I both know sometimes when we try to do interviews with other police departments, they won't talk because they're working the case and we don't know, they could be close. They, you know, they don't want to jeopardize anything. So that's what I'd like to think is, you know, hey, they don't want to say anything because they're keeping everything close to the chest, and maybe they are working on these things.
Right. And then, you know, there's this, like we talked about, the security officer. And according to Maggie, he was pretending to be involved in the case. He was putting up a lot of things that people do when they're very guilty.
That's true. When they say return or see how much they know. And I mean,
return to the scene of the crime, or try to somehow insert themselves into the investigation, which he was doing all of those things.
And I mean, he could have been one too that, I mean, we already know he made Brittany uncomfortable. She blocked him, you know, on social media and on her phone. He couldn't call her anymore. So there's just different things that we know she did not feel comfortable with him. So, and again, if they were going on the profile, like one thing Maggie said in her interview was, well, you know, you compared it to the killer's DNA. So yes, the security guard might not have matched then, but now you're saying that that DNA is not the killer. Have you gone back and tested new DNA? Then they might have the answers.
So the DNA you're saying tested against her fingernails, the rape kit.
That maybe DNA can now answer because he was ruled out because it didn't match that DNA.
And they may be doing that, and we just don't know. You know, the truth is some police departments work really well with us, and there are others that do not. And so in terms of want to give out information. So we are hoping that is the case. Either way, I think that it seems to me, I just have a gut feeling that this one's going to be solved.
I hope so too. I feel it too. And again, now Maggie's big mission now is still to just get more information out there. She doesn't want to die with her case unsolved and leave it to her son.
Right. I mean, that's what a lot of parents always say, is that they feel like they're handing a burden over to their other children or to other family members. Obviously that's one of those things you and I have heard that time and time again. So that must be something that, you know, a very real emotion and feeling.
And like, she's on social media all the time. She's very open to interviews and requests and just really would love to see someone just take this to another level, like our podcast. And like she said, podcasts are her lifeline to keep the story alive right now.
Yes. And we are just grateful that we can do anything we can to be able to help Maggie and Brittany and all the other families that we spotlight in these cases. And so we thank all of you for listening, and we hope that you will join us again for our next episode of Dealing Justice.
Like us on Facebook at Cold Case Playing Cards for all the latest information on this case and other cards we'll be featuring on future episodes. Dealing Justice is written, produced, and hosted by Jennifer Dubisak and myself, Lori Jennings. Our executive consultant is the Cold Case Playing Cards creator, retired FDLE Special Agent Tommy Ray. If you want to help us spread the word about these victims' stories, please subscribe and leave us a positive review on your favorite podcast app, and tell your friends to subscribe. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on Dealing Justice.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/audio.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.